Oh, that's right. We're here this afternoon with Congressman Jeff Duncan in studio with us today. So great. Now, let's see, Jeff, you were just over in Uptown Greenwood at Park Plaza. Saw some people over there, I presume?
Yeah, we had what we have dubbed community office hours, just making myself and my staff available to folks that wanted to come and talk with me about things or needed constituent work and begin that case file. So had a good crowd. I would say probably anywhere in the upper 20s probably were there. So it was good. And the solicitor came by, David Stumbo. I'm glad to see him. Your future sheriff came by. So it was a good event, yeah.
Who was that future sheriff?
I'm drawing a blank here. Help me out.
Dennis Kelly?
Yep, Kelly.
Okay, yeah. Dennis Kelly, yes. With the,
yep.
Yeah, okay.
So, thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. You're welcome.
It's been a long day.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, you've been...
Who do you think the future sheriff is?
Well, that's what I was asking you, see, because we've got two candidates, see. We've got Arnie Fisher and we have Dennis Kelly.
Well,
Arnie Fisher is the
Democrat. For the Republican and, candidate. I mean, yes. Okay.
Yeah, there is. But there are two candidates, yes. We are down to that.
You'll be nonpartisan, so I can pull for Mr. Kelly, so, yeah.
You know what I think is funny, though? Do we really think that a sheriff's office is a partisan office?
And I've always wondered that. Where do we draw the line with partisan politics with regard to sheriff's offices and county council even sometimes? So, but they are, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, you have been working a lot. You work a lot with Homeland Security. What do you think with Donald Trump down in Mexico today and the future of the wall? What do you think from a Homeland Security perspective as far as the wall?
Well, I have often said, even before I ran for Congress, that we need to do a better job securing our southern border. And I do believe we need more concrete, steel, and barbed wire. I've said that. But fencing and a wall isn't the total answer. There are areas along the southern border that you couldn't put a wall up without moving mountains, literally.
Right.
So more effective fencing is absolutely necessary, more fencing in general. And in 2006, Congress passed the Secure Fence Act, which said they were going to put more money behind more fencing in the border, and they haven't done it, never appropriated dollars for that. So the sense of Congress in 2006 was exactly my position. We've increased border personnel in the last decade or more, over double. But we still have an illegal immigration problem of folks crossing our border, whether they're unaccompanied minor children that come across, or whether it's folks coming to seek jobs and employment here, or whether it's nefarious folks that may want to do harm to this country. They can come across our southern border undetected, and they do every day. There's a term that DHS used up until recently, OTM, other than Mexican, as people that they have apprehended that are not of Latino-Mexican descent, and they could be from Africa, which they are. They could be from the Middle East, which they are, and they could be from East Asia and the Orient, which they are. And you have to wonder, are they coming for the jobs or are they coming for other reasons? And from a Homeland Security, national security aspect, I'm very, very concerned that folks can cross our border and what their ultimate goals are, or do they have nefarious aims?
Well, and we just don't seem to be able to qualify them, even though our government says they are able to qualify.
Well, they don't even want to use the term illegal alien anymore, which is a historical term. It's not derogatory. If you're here illegally, you're an alien, whether you're a citizen or non-citizen, illegal alien. And so folks that have not come through the normal process of obtaining a visa and permission slip to come into this country entered illegally. And whether they crossed the border, got off a ship or whatever, if they don't have a visa, they're here illegally. And we have whatever the number is, 10, 11, 12 million, 20 million. I don't know what the true number is, and I don't believe anybody's got their hands on that. But I do believe that we have to secure the border first to stop the bleeding, so to speak, as you would when you stop hemorrhaging, and then address the real issues, and that's national sovereignty, American sovereignty, and securing our border. And once we get a handle on border security and stopping the tide. Then we can decide what we want to do with the illegal aliens that are here and what we want to do about future expansion of guest worker programs or whatnot. But I don't think you do any of that until you secure the border, because I think it's futile.
Well, what do you think about Donald Trump and the wall that he wants to build? Or is he going to, do you think he's, they talk about a softening. Do you think he still is for building a wall? What do you think is going to happen there in Mexico?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the meeting today. I'm not privy to the discussions happening in Mexico City. I applaud Donald Trump for going down as chairman of the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee. I have a lot of interaction with the Mexican ambassador and with folks in Latin America in general. And I applaud him for going down and reaching out. I think we've ignored our neighbors in this hemisphere for much too long, focusing on the Middle East. There's a lot of opportunities for American businesses and American citizens in this hemisphere. So I applaud him for going to Mexico, and I hope he'll expand that. And I hope he'll go to Panama. I hope he'll go to Venezuela eventually with a new government there, which we can talk about, and I'd like to as well. I hope he goes to Argentina and meets Mauricio Macri. I hope he goes to Peru. I hope he goes to Colombia. There are a lot of opportunity there. So I applaud him. And when you ask about the wall, as I said earlier, I think we ought to have more fencing. You know, whether it's a wall or fence, whatever you call it, it needs to be an impenetrable barrier to stop and stem the tide of illegals coming into this country.
Well, I know they've talked about if it was a 15-foot wall.
Well, it just got 10-foot taller, Anne.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, 25. You know, but just depending on the height, they seem to have a ladder to come over. But yeah. One of the interesting things that I found when I was up there in Washington, D.C., and you and I had the opportunity to talk at the immigration fair, is that the immigrant situation, according to the ranchers, is somewhat better. But what is continually to be a huge problem is the drugs coming across.
And right. Just drugs and drug cartels.
There just can't seem to be any staying of the drug part of it.
I don't know that I agree with the idea or the thought process that the immigration situation has gotten better, because I hear from ranchers that are still fearful for leaving their family at their home as they go into town, or even go on their own property, leaving their family unattended because of the folks that are crossing their property, not crossing U.S. property or even state property, but drill it on down to the individual rancher's property.
Sure. So it's still
a concern.
There on the border.
Yeah, that's right. And we saw in Arizona last night a sheriff deputy, pronounced Babo, I believe, won a congressional race, or run the Republican primary. Anyway, we'll see what happens in the general. But I'm sure this was a topic of that
I
platform.
I had the opportunity to interview him.
Oh, yeah, really? Great guy. He's come to our committee twice, I know, in Homeland Security as we've addressed these issues. So it's an issue that the Arizonans, the New Mexicans, the people in Texas, people in California probably grasp more than we do. We still have an unaccompanied children issue. And this summer, there's been an influx of unaccompanied children coming from the Northern Triangle countries into this country, and that's El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras, and Guatemala. Not Nicaragua, Guatemala, coming into this country. And so we still know that there's this migration north. We're still seeing Cubans fleeing Cuba and getting into Central America and flowing north because they're concerned that normalization relations with the U.S. and Cuba will end their special status. So they're trying to get in this country before that status change so that they can request amnesty and be political refugees. So there's a lot going on within this hemisphere and with the border. It's not just Mexicans wanting to come do the jobs
absolutely.
And golf courses.
Absolutely. So. But I was just curious how you felt about the wall, and how do you feel about Donald Trump?
I'm fully behind Donald Trump as a Republican nominee, and I think we do better trying to influence him between now and the time he's sworn in as president than we do sticking our finger in his eye and not support him. So what I'm trying to do as a member of Congress, a future member in the next Congress, I hope, because I am running for re-election, I hope to get re-elected, is try to influence him on making conservative choices for the Supreme Court, conservative choices for his cabinet, and find policies that we can work on together from a conservative standpoint to limit government, institute more free market principles, and return power to the states and the people. That's ultimately what I went to Congress to do, and that's what I hope to influence the Trump administration on.
Absolutely. Well, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about what's going on, so don't you go away. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. If you got a question for Jeff, this is your opportunity. Pick up that phone. Give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery, this afternoon. Congressman Jeff Duncan is in the building. You know, Jeff, the other day, I think you put out a tweet about Homeland Security getting involved in voting, controlling, making sure that voting is correct when we go to the polls. And you and I were just talking, we'll talk about that in a minute, but you and I were just talking about, you know, what about putting purple thumbs or black thumbs, doesn't matter, but something on your thumb so when you walk out that you can prove that you voted and they know that you voted.
Well, more importantly, that you don't vote more than once.
Right.
Right, because there's evidence there. That happens in third world countries like Iraq, and where we've actually helped them institute some of their voting practices. If we're going to talk about the integrity of our election system and all that, these folks like Harry Reid and Eric Holder and Jay Johnson, I would ask them, how you feel about voter ID, where we can make sure that those people who come to vote are who they say they are.
Correct.
And they are registered, and we can, you know, match up their name and their voter registration and the picture on that ID. And I just think that's important. I would look for that as being the first thing I would do for integrity.
But what's interesting, Homeland Security be there monitoring it? Is that what we're talking about?
They shouldn't be. I mean, they're concerned. We all ought to be concerned about cyber terrorism and hacking and whatnot. And they say that the election system in Illinois and Arizona were hacked by some foreign entity. When I get back to Washington next week, I'll get the facts on that. I don't want to speak wrongly about whether they did or didn't, okay? But I do know on August the 3rd, Jay Johnson said that maybe the federal government ought to take over the elections process. When I think about this, there's really only two political positions that are elected by all 50 states, and that's the president and the vice president. Everything else in some facet is a state election. The state election commissions actually handle and monitor elections in each state. And the elections, I hold a federal office, but I don't represent 50 states. Although you can make the argument I serve in Congress, and I do, votes I take affect the whole nation. They do. But I have 770,000 people that I represent, and I represent the home state of South Carolina. Our United States senators represent the state of South Carolina, and they're elected by the state of South Carolina only. I'm elected by 770,000 or when some fraction thereof that actually participate in the voting process. That's who I represent. Only the president and the vice president are elected and represent the whole nation, so to speak. And so why should we allow the federal government to be involved in state elections? The state election commission has run it, historical. And I wonder the constitutional role of the federal government being involved in those state elections. I don't see one. So there's a lot of questions to be asked and answers to be given on this issue.
You know, we've been dealing with these hackings and all the things that have been happening, Jeff. I mean, Homeland Security, their position is to keep America safe. Is that their general?
22 agencies brought together after 9/11 to create an agency so that information could be shared and we don't have walls of separation and little fiefdoms of dominion. So that's what DHS is charged with, is keeping America safe and making sure that we don't miss the things that we missed in 9/11.
And how do you think it's going? How do you think it's being done?
I think now we have this big cumbersome bureaucratic agency of 22 agencies that still try to maintain some of their identity, even though they're part of DHS now. And I think the process is possibly slower, and information is not shared as well as it was prior to. I do think that we needed to address, after 9/11, the failures. But we've seen failures just recently with the Boston bombing and the individuals that traveled to Russia and the Russian letter informing us and how those signals were missed, and others, San Bernardino and Orlando and other things that are missed. And so I wonder about the effectiveness of this huge bureaucracy known as DHS, and I'm very, very vocal about that within the committee. I've said exactly what I've said today there. I do recognize that the failures of 9/11 should be addressed, and I don't know if this was the best way to do it, though, even though a Republican president put this forward.
Well, as we move forward, we're talking about Gitmo prisoners possibly coming to South Carolina, closing Gitmo. Of course, has been President Obama's fondest desire since he was elected. We're down to 61 prisoners there. What's going to happen?
First off, the terrorist.
Terrorists, okay.
Yeah. There's 61 terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, people that were caught on the battlefield as being part of some movement, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda or some Islamic radical jihad element that want to do harm to America. They're held there. The ones that are left are the worst of the worst. And they don't need to come to U.S. soil. That's not just my opinion. That goes back to 2009 when Nancy Pelosi ran the House and Harry Reid ran the Senate in the National Defense Authorization Act. Language was put forth by the Democrats and signed by the president that said is illegal to bring any Guantanamo Bay terrorists to U.S. soil. And that same language has been in the NDAA from 2009 till 2016. So it is against the law for the president to bring Guantanamo Bay terrorists to U.S. soil. No state should be a terrorist dumping ground, and specifically South Carolina doesn't need to be a terrorist dumping ground. We don't need them in Charleston at the Navy Brig, although it's a good facility. It's less than a mile away from an elementary school. So what happens if you bring them to U.S. soil? Then those facilities possibly become targets for acts of terror to either try to free them or make a political statement about Guantanamo Bay and terrorism and all in general. So we're going to fight the administration. I've got H.R. 617, which would give the House legal standing to sue the president should he try to violate the NDAA and bring those prisoners here.
And that's something you want to take up when you get back?
I hope so. We're going to continue to push leadership to bring that bill to the floor. I would think they would want that sort of legal standing. It expedites things. It's not just a piece of legislation for feel-good. It actually makes the vehicle possible in order for us to expedite some court action, get an injunction to stop this.
An executive order trump that?
No. Well, the court's going to step in, as it did on the executive amnesty issue, put a stay in effect, although the Obama administration in a lot of ways ignored that by continuing to rent office space, hire people at the USCIS to try to implement his executive memo on amnesty. Ultimately, the court ruled in my favor and the Republicans' favor to stop that illegal executive memo. So we can do that, and we go to the court. They're an equal branch of government. There's three branches of government, not just one, and it's not led by Barack Obama. They're all supposed to be equal. And we can utilize the court for this as well.
All right. Hey, I tell you what, we are coming up on South Carolina Radio News. We'll be right back. Don't you go away.
Stephen Schuford tosses his cap in the air during his graduation ceremony. After returning home, it's only a short time before he receives a job offer from cancer research firm Kiatech. Today, he's a dedicated cancer scientist and also a cancer survivor. Stephen works diligently in the Cancer Research Lab, thanks in part to his lottery scholarship. And it's all because people like you play the South Carolina Education Lottery. The impact of an education is beyond words.
Oh, that's right. We are right back here. Sharp Facets Gallery. Congressman Jeff Duncan is with us, sitting right across the table here from me this afternoon. It's good to have you in studio with us.
Well, it's great to be in the studio, and I love coming and sitting across the table from you, looking you in the eye. It beats the heck out of the phone line.
It sure does. Yeah. Absolutely, it does. You can really get a feel for what is thinking in that person's mind when you're absolutely looking across the table from them.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
exactly. And I know that's why a lot of the, we'll call them investigations, whatever you do, you love having somebody in the hot seat. I've seen you get riled up when people don't give you the right answers.
Right.
Or the real answer. Maybe we should not say the right answer, the real answer. We get a lot of that up there in Congress.
Yeah, we do. Whether it's Department of Interior or Secretary Johnson or you know, even Roberta Jacobson, who is now the ambassador to Mexico, who was the undersecretary for foreign affairs in the Western Hemisphere. So I keep them honest. I try to.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you, you know, you've, we've had a change. We had John Boehner, and now we have Paul Ryan in that seat. How are you thinking things are running now?
I still think the jury's out. I mean, I give Paul the benefit, Speaker Ryan the benefit of the doubt, because I see what he's trying to do with the appropriations process. Off there, we were talking about when we get back in September that the fiscal year runs out September 30th. We've got to fund government somehow, and whether that looks like a CR or an omnibus or whatever is still being debated. But Paul likes the what's called regular order, normal process, trying to pass the 12 appropriations bills to fund government through that normal appropriations process. And I buy into that. I think that's exactly the right thing to do. That's regular order, something I've advocated for. And it gives general members like me, who aren't in the room when the CR or the omnibus is crafted, have no input on that, gives us a chance during the normal appropriations process to offer amendments to redirect funding, limit funding, or represent our districts with how those agencies are going to spend that money. And that's the right way, and that's what Paul wants to get back to, Speaker Ryan wants to get back to, and that's what I want to get back to. So,
and that's, we ran out of money. We need a new at the end of September.
Yeah, we got to fund government by the end of September.
Here's an idea. Yeah. Let's not fund the government.
Yeah, we tried that one time and got beat up in 2013. And my leadership will tell you they don't think that helps us win in November by having a government shutdown. So I'm not going to advocate for shutdown. I didn't advocate for a shutdown then. What I advocated for was us continuing to use these must-pass pieces of legislation to affect policy. Primarily at that point in time was Obamacare. You know, we just need to fund government right now and try to get through the election process and get into the next administration and the next Congress, because there'll be a new Congress will be seated in January. So that what we're talking about off the air is how long that next funding bill lasts, whether it's a year-long CR, which will go from September 30th or October 1st, rather, to September 30th next year, or whether it's short-term and going to December 18th and expiring right before Christmas, or whether it expires in February or March in the next year and next administration and next Congress, which is what I would like to see. And so that's going to be the discussions that are probably get a little bit heated in September between members in our conference on when that expiration should happen, and whether it's a CR, a continuing resolution, or whether it's a an omnibus bill, which has a lot of policy in it. Paul Ryan, Speaker Ryan, said he doesn't want another omnibus. I'm going to hold him to that and do a CR. I'm willing to accept a little bit higher spending level based on where we are right now and the number that was deemed last year at that spending level, if we can extend that into early next year and give a new Congress a chance and a new president a chance to have input on spending for the remainder of that fiscal year. Because as I told you, I don't think that we ought to have anything expiring a lame duck and give outgoing members of Congress like Harry Reid, who's retiring, people that were defeated by their constituents in November, and a lame duck president another bite at the apple of spending your taxpayer dollars. Because they're not accountable to anyone at that point in time, so why should we give them the ability to spend money? I don't think we should. So let's let the new Congress that is accountable to the voters, new president that is accountable to the voters, have an opportunity to direct that spending.
You know, well, that brings me to another question, too, Jeff. What do you think about term limits? Should we have term limits for Congress, for senators? Should we have that?
We do. Every 2 years for House members and 6 years for the Senate.
Yes and no. I would say yes and no.
Well,
yes,
you will have people lose the election. Hopefully not Jeff Duncan, 3rd District of South Carolina. But you will
how
have.
How long should a congressman or a senator stay in that office? Is it a good idea to have new blood coming in?
Absolutely. You know, I support term limits. Always have. I wasn't being facetious in that we already have them. If we truly focused on, you know, our job as the electorate and what we believe and our congressmen how long they should stay, how effective they are. I've embraced term limits. One of the first bills I signed back in 2011, after you were sitting at my desk in my office in 116 Cannon in January of 2011, one of the first bills I co-sponsored was a term limit bill. So something I believe in. I believe it ought to be reasonable.
Sure.
I believe that you've got to give people a chance to learn where the bathroom is, so to speak, you know, learn their way around, learn the process, and be effective.
What about a fact of a two-year term? Do you think that's too short a term?
That's too
short it
a
seems
term.
Like every time you turn around, you're running.
I'm running. But that's how our founders wanted it. I mean, they wanted to see the House, which is closest to the people's House, to reflect the will of the voters more regularly. So they gave it a chance, the voters a chance, to turn that over more frequently to reflect the will. And I think you do see that in the House, and the House reflects the will of the people. You can go back to the 2000s when the Republicans didn't do what they said they would do, and then the nation gave the Democrats control of the House for a few terms there, and then they came back in 2010, took it away from them because they were misguided in what they did. They were too heavy-handed on America with Obamacare and a couple other things like Dodd-Frank. So you've got that, and then you've got the Senate that's every 6 years, but it's staggered. So one-third, one-third, one-third is always turning over to reflect the will. And then you've got a four-year period for the president, which isn't going to really reflect the changing mood more regularly. That's why we're on two. So I stand by the wisdom of the founding fathers, but going back to your question about term limits, so what is reasonable? Is it six terms for members of Congress and three terms for the Senate, or some blend of that?
Sure.
You know, six terms for Congress, 12 years, kind of gives you a chance. I've only been there six. I kind of know my way around now, kind of starting to build some respect and understanding with my colleagues and starting to be a little more effective. The Senate, you go three terms, that's three times six, that's what, 18 years. They get a chance to be there long enough to, you know, something.
I just think there should be, because I think one of the things that happens is people get very comfortable in whether the person is actually doing the job or not. People get comfortable.
Absolutely. I mean, there are too many of my colleagues that just like being called congressman. You know, they like having that title and that element of respect or whatever.
Sure.
I didn't go up there for a title. I got enough on my tombstone and my obituary as it stands. So,
you've got it all ready to go. I just need to ask. Well, I mean, you know, have you already made it?
I'm not there for a title.
Okay.
I want you to call me Jeff. I'm a congressman. That's my role. But I'm not there for a title. I'm there to be effective and try to move the ball forward for the things that I believe in and what I campaign on and what I have campaigned on as a candidate for numerous times here is limited government, free markets, and individual liberties, returning power to the states and the people, a constitutional rule of government, redefining the federal government back to its 17 enumerated powers in the Constitution, and reining in government where it's overstepped those enumerated powers, getting back to that separation of powers, what the executive is supposed to do, what the legislative branch is supposed to do, and what the judicial branch is supposed to do. We're way beyond what our founders ever envisioned. And you say, well, that's a utopian view of government. No, it's a constitutional view of government.
But can it be pulled back, Jeff? This is the thing that I keep looking at. Can it even be pulled back?
And that's a great question. That's a great question, and it's something I've struggled with, because after 6 years being there, I don't think Congress will ever rein in its power to appropriate dollars. That's why you'll never see a balanced budget amendment pass the United States Congress and be sent to the states. I don't believe you'll ever see term limits. Although we can agree that term limits are necessary, I don't believe Congress will ever do that on its own. That's why our founders, who envisioned this day when Congress would not do that, they gave us a thing called Article 5. And Article 5 calls for a convention of the states. Then the convention of the states is where states send a delegation to a convention. It's not a constitutional convention. It's not what they call a con-con. They can't have a runaway convention because there's some fail-safe methods there. So the states send their delegations to a convention, and amendments are proposed that have to be voted on by that convention of states. And these are state delegates supposed to represent their states, just like they did in 1787. So the amendments are adopted by the convention. Do they change the Constitution? Not yet. Because those amendments have to go to the states to be ratified, just like any amendment the Constitution passed by Congress would have to be ratified by two-thirds of the states. So we're going to take two-thirds of the states to ratify the amendment to change the Constitution. But it can be changed. Now, If you look at the number of states that have balanced budget requirements in their own state constitutions, and you think about the nation as a whole, I would say WCRS, Sharp Facets, Ann Eller, all have to live within their means. It's okay to have to borrow money from time to time. You have to plan to have a plan to pay it back. There ought to be a mechanism for the country to borrow money in time of war, national crisis, and
sure,
other things.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. But in a normal day-to-day function, we have to live within our means, and that is within a balanced budget in our homes and our businesses, and government should have to operate that way as well. And most states have that requirement. Not all, but most. So I think a balanced budget amendment adopted by a convention of the states would be ratified by two-thirds of the states, because they would say, yeah, the federal government ought to live within its means, right? And then there might be amendments offered to reaffirm what the Second Amendment truly stands for, to kind of clear up some of this misunderstanding around the country that the liberals want to put forth about militias and whatnot. Maybe we clarify what freedom of religion truly is and this wall of separation between government, and it goes back to the letter to Danbury, Connecticut by Thomas Jefferson that's been used to interpret what freedom of religion and the role of government is. So maybe amendments are offered to clarify some of that. Maybe we get into life issues. Maybe we get into marriage issues. I don't know. But it's going to take, I believe, the majority of the delegates within the convention. So that's if every state sends three, that's 150 delegates. So it's going to take 76 of those delegates, I believe, to adopt the amendment.
But what do you think the possibility of something like that happening?
There's 30-something states that I believe that have signed on to it. It's going to take about 37 or 38 to get to the required number to actually hold a convention. It's interesting that next month, the Article 5 Convention of the States Project is holding a mock convention in Williamsburg, Virginia, to actually show America how this process could and should work, which I think that's great because there's so much misunderstanding out there. It took me a long time to get to this point, but at the end of the day, I think of it like this. I believe in the United States Constitution. I believe in the founders that wrote that document and set up this government. Just like I believe in the Holy Bible and my Christianity and what Christ did for me, I can't take the Bible and say, you know, we ought to love each other, and let's just look at the book of John as the book of love, and let it be the only guiding principle for our Christianity, and we'll just abandon Paul's conviction in Romans,
right?
Because that's kind of trampling on my toes. So we're not going to, we can't do that. You can't pick and choose in the Bible.
Right.
You either believe Jonah was swallowed by a whale, and you believe that Christ died on the cross, and you believe that even when I was still a sinner, Christ died for me. You believe all that.
Okay.
I have to believe the Constitution as well. And Article 5 is in the Constitution because I believe our founders envisioned a day such as this. And so you can't say, well, I believe in the Bill of Rights and I believe in the separation of powers, but Article 5, yeah, I'm not going to believe in that. You got to take it all or none, in my opinion.
I think you definitely have a point there. So futuristically, if we are looking at the way our country is leaning, though, our country is leaning what way? Conservative, more liberal, more socialistic, government taking care of all the immigrants that we have coming
depends
in.
Depends on who you're listening to.
Sure.
and where you're at. So if you look at it from the national media, you would say we're trending left. If you look at it from the big states, California, New Jersey, New York, Illinois, you would say it's more big government, progressive policies of taking care of everybody. But if you truly look at the makeup of governors and state legislatures in this country, they're trending Republican. We've got more state legislatures are in the majority Republican and more Republican governors, I believe, than we've had in a very, very long time. So I would say that the state governments themselves, the ones that are closer to the people, are
right,
trending Republican. And because of that, guess who sends the delegates to the convention of the states? The state legislatures. And so timing is right for Republican state legislatures to send more conservative, freedom-loving delegates from their states to a convention that may be more like-minded to Republicans. And I think that's a winning time for us.
Okay. So
that may not be what you think, but
no,
that's what
no.
I believe.
No, yeah. I mean, I do. I think that you are correct. It's just as we look at this whole country and as we look at the, I'm going to say, the kind of the hold that Hillary has futuristically here on the election, I wonder, and I know a lot of people are afraid of where this country is headed.
And they've got every right to be when you watch Waterworld and you see the ignorance out there about the founders and about government and policies and whatnot. Educate yourself, folks. And while we're talking about education, let me just touch on one thing. This is the centennial for the National Park Service.
Yes, okay? It is. I've talked about it a lot. Yep.
And I was down at 96 today at Star Fort and the national park there and actually helped shoot some video for them talking about the importance of it. And 100 years the national parks have been around and how important it is to learn American history. And
that's something that's having a hard time right now, Jeff. And civics is the other one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think our education system has failed our students in so many ways in that they rushed through the history and the founding documents and our founding fathers and the Mayflower Compact and why the Pilgrims came here in the first place and what their thought process was. And that ultimately led to 1776 and 1787 and important dates in the history of this country. But going back to 96, the importance of these battles that happened in the Southern Campaign, that happened at places like 96, that happened at places like Cowpens and Kings Mountain and even Musgrove Mill in Lawrence County, where a lot of British officers were killed or wounded by militia there in a small, what they call a skirmish. But it was so important because the Battle of Kings Mountain may have turned out differently had those officers been on the field and not killed and wounded at Musgrove Mill. So it's if you learn some of that and you learn some of these American history issues, then I think you become a better citizen. You take your right to vote a lot more seriously, and you really focus on and understand why we can't allow an executive in the White House to step over that line of separation of powers and legislate from the executive office because he didn't have the constitutional power to do that. You know, I think our founders understood that since the fall of man in the Garden of Eden, that man is sinful in nature. And if he had a lot of power, he would lust for more and garner more power into himself. So absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's why they divided power into three branches of government to keep that from happening. They wanted to divide that power up, and they did. And we're seeing some muddying out of those waters, and we've got to reaffirm that. And you do that by understanding from the get-go why they did that.
And then, of course, we've got the Supreme Court there. We've got judges that we've got one out, and we could have a couple more out. And where would we be if it became even more liberal-leaning?
Well, here's the thing. That's why this election is so critical, that we need to put, a Republican president in there, and I need to make sure Republicans quit sticking their finger in Donald Trump's eye, and we actually can work with him and influence him in some way to put a conservative Supreme Court justice on the bench. Hillary Clinton said Barack Obama would make a great Supreme Court justice. Now, I think he'd make a terrible Supreme Court justice, and I do not want that. And if no other reason, that's reason to vote for Donald Trump. But so we may have multiple. I have a novel idea. If another one resigns or dies on the Supreme Court before Justice Scalia's seat is filled, why don't we allow the court to revert back to seven justices, the pre-FDR court? So if you know history, you know, in FDR's term, he tried to pass the New Deal programs, the big social programs that grew government so much. And they were turned down. They were ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So what did FDR do? He influenced Congress, Democrat Congress as well, to stack the Supreme Court. They went from 7 to 9. So they added members to the Supreme Court so we'd have more like-minded members that he appointed,
right,
confirmed by a Senate that was like-minded. So it went from 7 to 9, and once they stacked the court in their favor, the New Deal programs were passed by Congress again that grew government. And all of a sudden, we have the New Deal actually ruled constitutional now. So I've got a novel idea. If this seat and the next one that may be vacate are not filled, why not revert back to 7 Supreme Court justices, because that's what the Constitution called for originally, was 7. It's a novel idea that nobody's thinking about.
Idea.
Everybody's going to say, oh, no, we need 9, you know.
Gotta have 9. Yep.
Wait a minute, there was 7 up until, 1930-something, so why not go back to 7? It worked for a long time.
You know, so many people have come out, so many people, particularly some of our bigger leaders, have come out and not not endorsed Donald Trump, and yet they don't want to vote for Hillary, but they talk about maybe voting for the Libertarian or voting not at all. And what do you have to say to those people that just are just, I think they're being stupid, but...
Get your head out of the sand.
Yeah.
You know, by doing that, then you're not going to have any, if you're a member of Congress and you're saying, you're not going to have any influence on Donald Trump. You know, it's pivotal. It's a crucial time in our country, the Supreme Court and other things. And do we continue down this progressive policy path of Keynesian economic policies that don't work? We see no GDP growth, relatively speaking, in this country. The Fed has no room to inject anything into the economy through low interest rates to stimulate. They can't print any more money in QE 1, 2, 3, or 4, whatever we are now. They just don't have any room to do that. So government policies and Fed stimuluses will not work and are not available. What will work? Broadening the tax base and putting Americans to work, unleashing and unbridling the innovative and entrepreneurial spirit that we do that, that Americans have. We do that by less regulation, less taxation, and getting the government the heck out of the way. I believe Donald Trump gets that. He's a businessman. He knows that the job creators will create jobs and this economy can get turned around if government is limited and we get out of the way. And so I think that that is why. Because everybody listening knows somebody in their family, in their Sunday school class, neighbors, or whatever, they're out of work and been out of work for, you know, a long time. They're on some sort of government assistance that our tax dollars pay for. And so we need to put more Americans to work. We need to turn the economy around through free market principles and not through Keynesian progressive policies. And so it's important. Supreme Court's in play. That's important. And yeah, so I would say get your head out of the sand. Let's support the Republican nominee. Let's try to work with him to make sure conservative policies are passed, to make sure conservative people are surrounding, and make sure conservatives are considered for the bench. And let's move on down the road.
Absolutely. You know, Obamacare, there's been a lot of talk about doing away with it, but replacing it with something. What is your feeling? What is your feeling in Congress? What are you seeing? If Donald Trump wins, then that is a possibility. Donald Trump doesn't win, then that's not a possibility.
Well, that's one of the areas where Donald Trump has been a little wishy-washy and unclear about his position about Obamacare and a single-payer system and whatnot. We're headed toward a single-payer system. You got companies, Aetna and others, that are leaving the states, and you're beginning to see a trend toward some single-payer, which is what the Obama administration and the progressive wanted all along. They just decided to phase this in and allow this thing to go slowly to get to their goal. I would ask Donald Trump, you know, personally, you know, where he stands on a repeal and replace aspect. I know what my plan is. We need to inject more free market principles. We need to allow you to own that policy and be able to take that policy across state lines, just like you would your car insurance, your life insurance, or whatnot. Own that policy. Allow insurance to be sold across state lines. Create that Geico and Progressive are successful because they can sell all over the country, and you own the policy.
Sure.
So, why didn't we do some of that? And then the most needy, there are qualified community health centers. That's a great program that the federal government supports. That it's where the rubber meets the road for health care providing and create a health home for folks. So get out of the emergency room. And we need to address EMTALA, which is emergency medicine and allows you to go to the emergency room and you have to be screened. It doesn't say you have to be treated. You are most times, but under the law, they don't have to. This is Ronald Reagan's plan. So I'm not anti-EMTALA. What I'm saying is we need to readdress that and redefine that you can be screened, and then we're going to send you to somewhere. If you've got an earache and you go to the emergency room, you shouldn't be in the emergency room, right?
Correct.
But you need treatment because you're hurting. So maybe they send you to a qualified community care center, and you can get treatment, get antibiotics, and take care of your problem that way. But if you're bleeding and squirting blood halfway across the room, that's an emergency.
Absolutely. You know? So. You know you're listening to WCRS, and you know that Ann Eller had Congressman Jeff Duncan in the building sitting across from me. It has been a great pleasure to have you sit down with us today.
Ann, it's been great. Hey, online or whatever, and thanks for having me. I look forward to coming back. Yeah,
absolutely.
God bless you.
Absolutely. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood, 98.5 and 1450 AM. That's going to do it for me. Bye-bye.